Case of the Frozen Pussy, Slip or Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will find on the Miami Memoirs podcast. Strange Cases and Wild Tales presents real case histories and true stories related to the law practice and experiences of a creative Florida attorney reaching out over 60 years. There's more than meets the eye. In these sparkling memoirs, Florida attorney Louis Ress uncorks a caseload of true, weird, wonderful and wild stories from an always eventful 6 decades of life in the law. Before we begin, I would like to tell you about a new book from Louis. Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. Round 2 from the amazing life and times of legendary South Florida attorney Louis Ress takes readers from Brooklyn in the 1940s, via a spell in a top-secret army department, and a transatlantic solo flight in a replica Spirit of St. Louis, to adventures in and out of the courtroom in a sometimes rougher-than-ready 50s and 60s Miami. The book is available on Amazon, just search Louis Ress. And now let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. Today, we'll be doing episode 39, You Never Know. Louis, who is Don Foiler? Is that his real name?
Fowler. Don Fowler.
Oh, sorry.
That's his real, no, that's not his real name. You know me. I change everything. I don't want to be sued, number one, he's still alive.
Uh-huh.
Number two, foul is a good word because he was a very foul guy.
Okay.
So it's a good story. And it's just, this is, you never know what happens. This is a story about my law practice. And Don Fowler was a second-tier partner in our small, crazy, but very successful law firm. And he was a good trial lawyer. He was handling some of the insurance company's files for the Aetna Casualty Insurance Company. And he started out with simpler matters, such as suing for damaged property where the insurance company pays to its policyholder, and then the policyholder has to assign his rights to the insurance company back, and the insurance company steps in the policyholder's shoes and can sue a third party. For example, if you're in an auto accident, somebody hits your car and you have property damage, and let's say you have a $500 deductible. You pay the $500, your insurance company may pay $5,000 to get your car repaired, and there you sit. Well, the party that caused the accident has insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they're liable. They may be personally liable. So
right.
No one goes after them for the $5,000 that the insurance company paid out. And certainly not for the $500. It's almost not worth it on your deductible.
Mm-hmm.
So it sits. So the insurance company comes to a law firm and they say, take over these cases and stand in the client's shoes, in our insured's shoes, and sue the third party that caused this accident and get a judgment against him, his insurance company, and see if you can collect it. If not, we record the judgment and someday they'll have to come in and pay it off. They'll have a problem. They want to get a loan. Something will come up. Where they want to have a clean, record
clean record
in there, and they don't want a judgment against themselves, so they'll come and pay it off.
I see.
It's a whole practice. It's called subrogation.
Wow, yeah, it's
and,
very intense.
Yeah, and it's tricky because you got to get the insurance companies insured, the person that received the benefit, to cooperate. And
exactly.
They don't want to cooperate.
Of course not.
They walk away from the $500 bucks. They don't want to help the insurance company get the $5,000 that they paid out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a battle to treat them nicely and be kind to them and make them like you and make them want to cooperate. You can't threaten them. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's where he was doing that type of work.
Mm-hmm.
And after he became quite good at it, we gave him other stuff to do for the insurance companies, other work. And he ingratiated himself and he entertained them. And we also gave him a buy-sell agreement where if he ever left us for any reason, we would buy out his ownership interest in the firm. Let's say he had 5% ownership in the firm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had a building and we had equipment and we had accounts receivable and cash in the bank. So that 5% was worth a good bit of money and we'd have to buy it out. If he left. And and we had no restrictions about where he could go or what he could do or whether he could compete with us.
Exactly.
I thought I would be Mr. Nice Guy, and you don't practice. We're professionals, and we don't do that, and he would never steal from us or try to take away our clients or damage us, would he? Would he? Well, he had locked up this business with the Aetna casualty, and he was handling some of their personal injury files, and he was trying some workers' compensation cases, and they were pleased with him, as were we. And I gave him an allowance to entertain the insurance company employees, the adjusters, and he was getting files sent directly to him from the insurance company. I was impressed. I mean, that should have alerted me, but I figured, well, he was...
maybe he's doing a good job.
Yeah, he was, and he wanted to go up in the ranks and not have 5%, maybe 10 or 15 or 20% of the firm. So I didn't realize that he had a plan of stealing the Aetna from us and leaving us.
Oh, no. And so was that what happened? Were you right?
Oh, yeah. That's just what happened.
Oh,
how did you guess?
My gosh.
You got good insight. One Monday morning, I came into the office, in the firm's office, and his office was empty. All of the Aetna's files were gone, and all of his furniture was gone.
Oh, my goodness.
And
imagine
he took everything.
Walking into that.
He took everything, plus all his diplomas and everything else. It didn't take me long to learn that he had opened an office in Coral Gables, about 15 miles away. And not only had taken all of the Aetna files, but he had one of my attorney friends, Bernie Kessler, call me and advise me that he was representing Don Fowler, and to make sure that Don Fowler received his full payout for the 5% ownership in the firm, which turned out to be a good chunk of dough. It's a
that
good bit of money.
That was nasty of him. And to also drag in your friend, too, as a lawyer, as to be his to represent
it was
him,
nasty.
That is bad.
My relationship with Bernie Kessler never was the same. It really was damaged because how could you do that and go sue me or claim or threaten me to represent somebody that was working for me that left me and did me ill? That's a terrible thing to do. So sometimes it shows you if you represent the wrong person against someone you know, against a client or a friend, you make an enemy for life.
Yeah.
So, anyhow,
I mean, what kind of friend were they?
Right. To a great extent, it was my own fault. Because I had trusted Don, I had given him the insurance company work, I didn't protect myself or my law firm with a written agreement or a restriction of any kind. My relations with the adjusters at the Aetna had been slowly reduced, in part because Don was handling them so well, and I went on to do other things, some of them more lucrative. Insurance companies pay by the hour, and it's not a huge amount of money, and corporations will pay much more. And I was doing more lucrative work. So it was my own fault, too. It was. However, we still had the Travelers, which was a huge insurance company. And that's the Travelers Insurance, you know, the red umbrella they advertise on television. And they're big. And that, it was a giant. And we had been representing them for about 2 years. One day, I received a call from Marty Spencer, the claims manager of the Travelers Insurance Company. And Marty said, "Lewis, I would like to meet with you and discuss your handling some specialized work for the Travelers." That was how we started to. That's how we first got their business. He said, "I'm only interested in your handling arson cases for us and nothing more. You know what arson cases are? Fires.
Intentional fires."
So I said, "Marty, I certainly would be interested." And I met him in a small restaurant in Coral Gables. Marty Spencer was a senior claims manager. He was a very serious guy, and he had been around Miami for over 20 years. And he was a little bit gruff and very direct. And he said, "Lewis, I know just who you are. Bill Connors raves about you." He said, "The Aetna has won 2 huge fire cases as a result of your efforts. You know, at the last Claimsman Association meeting, not one of the managers had ever heard of anyone ever winning an arson case. So the Travelers needs a good arson defense lawyer, and if you're interested, we'd like to retain you. But you understand this will only be for arson cases, that's all, and your firm cannot sue Travelers or its policyholders, so this might not be such a good deal for you."
And why couldn't you sue Travelers insured people?
Well, because it would be like a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. That you can't sue a client.
Right.
And even though they're not the real party in interest, they are in fact paying the loss. And so we know we have inside information how they work. Mm-hmm. We have friendships with their adjusters. You can't deal where you're representing the adjuster in a case and then suing his
Makes
employer
sense.
And he's and defending it.
Right.
It's unethical. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't do that. But I said to him, Marty, we've considered everything, and it would be a feather in our cap to be able to say that we are counsel for travelers, because we could put it in our resume and records.
Yeah.
And we were eager to work with you. So we did. Mm-hmm. And
so tell me a little bit about arson cases.
Well, what happened was, not only did we have the arson cases, mm-hmm. but after a while we got to know the adjusters and we got to know the sub-managers, and they asked us to do other work for them, and we gradually became
That's great.
Very much involved with travelers, handling their entire line of cases. So you might wonder about the fire cases that mm-hmm. we were recommended. We were recommended by Bill Connors, who was the manager of the Aetna.
Mm-hmm.
And the arson cases that we represented the Aetna on were really exciting.
Hmm.
The first one was destruction by fire of a large clothing manufacturing plant on Miami Beach. The claims were for millions of dollars. And if the insurance company doesn't pay, they become liable for their insured's attorney's fees, which can be astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, interest and costs.
That adds up.
and the damages are huge. Shortly after the extensive fire had occurred, I was called in by the Aetna to evaluate the case. One always looks for the point of origin of a fire. Did it come from defective wiring?
Mm-hmm.
Did it come from a water heater, a stove, an appliance? A lot of these things are electrical in
right.
nature.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes it's a spill from a flammable item that spills over and ignites. Or it's an appliance that burns out.
You know, this whole time I thought arson was like an intentional fire.
It is. That's just what it is.
Mm.
And that's what these claims are about.
Ah, so it's dismissing if it's any of these accidental causes.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right. We came to the conclusion that the owner of the factory was losing money, and he torched it.
Uh-huh. It's a cash out somehow.
That's an arson.
Right.
And I'll tell you more about arson. It's a crime, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's an entire college dedicated to the study of fires and their causes. Firemen attend these classes, as do insurance experts. I had taken some of their courses, so the first thing I wanted to know was, how did it start? That's what we do. What is the point of origin of the fire?
Mm-hmm.
And in this instance, the arson was quite clear. The fire was so intense that the sprinkler system went off immediately, within
mm-hmm.
a very short time. And there was a fire trail, from the point where the torch went down, where the fire was started, showing a pattern of how highly inflammable liquid was poured over the stored cut clothing.
Oh.
These were men's suits.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sprinklers went off, so it showed a burn pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And there was little or no doubt that it was arson.
Yeah, clear.
So then we check to see how the company is doing economically. Is there a motive?
Yeah.
So the company's book showed an economic problem they were having. They were losing money.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, well, who did it? You know, is it an employee? Was it a relative? Was it a friend? Did they hire someone to do it? Was it the owner himself?
That's true,
and
yeah.
So the owner had been in the factory earlier on the Sunday, the day of the fire.
Huh. Well, I mean, is that about does it, right?
No. No. The insurance company has the burden to prove who did it.
Mm.
It could have been a competitor or a disgruntled employee or an enemy of the owner.
Right.
However, we were in luck. There was a 5-gallon gasoline can left on the floor.
Oh.
That's really stupid. The idiot who started the fire must have figured that it would be consumed in the fire, that it would blow up. It was,
yeah.
You know, with gasoline in it. But no, it was quite intact. Not only that, it was painted gray with a gray marine type of paint, like, you know, in the Navy, if you know, if it moves, salute it, and if it doesn't move, paint it gray.
Huh.
It was highly unusual. It was highly unique.
Uh-huh.
And the fire was caused by igniting gasoline because we did a chemical analysis of different material there, and it showed that it was gas. There's a chemical. You send it to the lab, and they tell you what it is, inflammatory liquid, and it was gasoline. So I had an idea. If the owner did it, he surely would not have wanted to transport a gasoline in his car for a long distance.
And, especially that amount that he probably had.
So what did we do? We said, let's see if there are gas stations near the factory that where the they might have seen the can being filled, probably on the Sunday, the day of the fire, which is an unusual day in a gas station to fill a can. Well, he would be awfully stupid to fill the can right near the factory. But let's say 3 or 4 miles away, it would be more likely because he wouldn't want to drive a long distance with the gasoline can in his car.
Exactly,
and it has an odor, too. So
so what
organized
did you do once
four teams.
Yeah, you got teams, wow.
And they went out to gasoline stations. We made a circle, a five-mile circle,
radius,
radiating from the factory. And each team had a series of photographs of the picture, and one of them was a picture of the factory owner, along with color photographs of the gray can, the gray gas can. Bingo. Exactly 5 miles from the factory, three people at a gas station picked the owner's photograph as the person having filled the gray painted gas can on the Sunday morning, the day of the fire.
Wow.
Bingo. No bingo.
No,
there was
yet.
A big celebration at the Aetna. Because
please,
you're talking about millions and millions of dollars.
So you got them, right? That was
Not so fast. They weren't admitting anything, and we had to prove it. And it's a tough burden of proof, and there's no witnesses. It's a very tough thing.
Yeah.
And these people can come in and say they saw him fill the can, and he said, I never did.
Right.
And it's their word against his.
Just keep saying, I didn't.
That doesn't put the gasoline on the fire or light the fire.
Yeah.
So I suggested that we file criminal charge of arson against this fellow because he was suing us for millions. And I went to the state's attorney's office, and when I told them the story, they filed a criminal charge on their own. And over the next 3 years, they had four different prosecutors come and go.
Wow.
Each one had to be briefed by me, prodded, cajoled, begged to go forward. Still no trial. We did all of the work for them. We brought in the witnesses. We produced the gray can. We showed them the financial losses and the records. We showed them photographs of the fire damage. We produced experts to show that it was arson, that it was intentional, that it was lit, and that it wasn't didn't come from combustion or spontaneous combustion. And still no trial.
And so what went on after during this time?
Well, in the meantime,
yeah.
I had taken the deposition of the owner of the company, and he had a good lawyer. Just like now, you hear about January 6th, they plead the Fifth Amendment, you know. Well, the Fifth Amendment is very interesting because in a civil case, it can be used against you as an admission of liability. It may protect you criminally. Well, you don't have to testify against yourself in a criminal matter. But in a civil matter, the court says, we're going to make this as an admission that you were not answering because you're liable.
Good to know.
So, yeah. So, after that, the judge was smart because the judge didn't compel him to answer. The judge gave him a continuance until the criminal matter was resolved. Because if he won the criminal case, then he would have to answer because there was no more exposure under the Fifth Amendment.
I see.
He had a continuance.
So what
finally,
next?
Finally, the criminal case came up for trial. Not the civil case. That was being held. In the criminal case, I was amazed that this fellow pleaded guilty.
Oh,
and he
did.
Was, and part of the, they copped a plea. They settled.
Huh.
And part of the settlement agreement was that they withdrew the lawsuit, the civil suit against the Aetna with prejudice, where they can never come back forever. It's all over.
Yeah, that means forever, yeah.
And he plea bargained, and he got a year in jail.
Wow. What a saga. Maybe he was just so tired of having to go to court. That he was like, you know what? I'm guilty. That's it.
No, sometimes it's smart to cop a plea and get a year rather than, you know what you're facing in arson? You know, you're looking at maybe 10 years.
Wow. Yeah,
and that's when no individuals
he
are
felt
involved.
The pressure. He
when
felt
no
the pressure.
People were occupying the place, you're looking at 10 years. If people are occupying the place, you're looking at 15 years, maybe. So
that's serious.
Maybe he was looking at 5 years at least, so he got 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good bargain for him.
And whatever happened to that second case?
Well, that was case number one.
Oh, yeah.
Arson case number two was even wilder. There's no doubt that this was a home fire caused by an electrical wire going from a 220-volt room wall air conditioner. You know those air conditioners that you put through the wall
mm-hmm.
in the room?
Mm-hmm.
They're 220 volts,
mm-hmm.
And it was connected to a wall outlet, you know, a plug in the wall.
Yeah.
And the Aetna insured the developer, Happy Homes. That's not that's not the name, but they used to sing the song, "You'll be happier in a happy home, so easy to own, so easy to own."
Mm, okay.
And it was a tract home. And they had like 300 homes in this development. And that was it. Life is better in a happy home. And that was the ad. And it worked. And the developer, Bill Humble, had sold out.
Mm.
And he was a very, very wealthy man.
Yeah.
And
tell us a little bit about what happened. What happened with that fire?
It was an interesting fire. The fire occurred in a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house. It was occupied by an Afro-American family. Their name was Sylvan. And during the night, a blaze started in the living room, and the house literally went up in flames.
Wow.
They had two young daughters and who had been asleep in the back bedroom. And in an effort to get out of the house, it was a wild blaze. They were severely burned all over. They were badly scarred on both sides of their faces and their arms, both arms, and their back. I mean, bad scars, like prunes.
Yeah.
And they were very nice, sweet, refined young ladies. One was 10 and the other 12. And they were innocent victims of a terrible, terrible fire.
And was it investigated?
Oh, yeah, sure. And the fire investigators are very thorough generally. And they narrowed the point of origin of the fire to the electric cord that ran between the 2-ton room wall air conditioner and the plug.
Hmm.
And it's a wire, you know, to connect it, to plug it
yeah.
in, to give it electricity. The Sylvan family had asked a neighbor to install the air conditioner, which they had purchased from Sears. They paid him $50 to do the job. So he cut through the wall,
mm-hmm.
and he put in the air conditioner, and he patched the wall, and he plugged it in. And the air conditioner had worked just fine for the 2 weeks that it had been in service.
Mm-hmm.
The lawsuit against Humble and Happy Homes was based on a claim that the house was not wired correctly. And as a result, there was an electric surge. You know, with
mm-hmm.
you've seen an electric surge, and then the lights blink and so on. After the surge, the wires got hot, and the wires actually melted, and that was the cause of the fire. When the wires got hot and melted, the insulation around the wires melted, and the wires, copper wires, were exposed, and they beat up. They formed little beads on them. It gets so hot.
Oh, my gosh.
And they pop off. They pop out of the wire,
yeah.
and they're like sparks,
mm-hmm.
and that ignited the whole fire.
Wow.
And that was the cause of the fire, which in turn caused the girls to suffer these horrible permanent injuries. They had a number, and the plaintiffs, the attorneys, had a number of electrical experts, including an engineer, ready to testify that the house was not wired correctly, that
uh-huh.
that's what caused the surge.
Right. And was there any evidence then of that?
Well, yes, there was. The actual wire was preserved, and it showed that it melted halfway to the plug between the air conditioner and the plug, and the wire connects them. Halfway down, it melted.
Uh-huh.
It burned out. And the insulation had melted off, and the wires were exposed, and you could see the copper beads, these little balls of metal. They showed right on the wire, and because the wire had melted at that point.
Uh-huh. No, I'm terrified of fires, so this just, oh my gosh.
I'm sorry to frighten you.
And so what did you do?
Well, the first thing I did was ask to have permission to have the wire and the plug examined by our expert.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to find out exactly what happened,
right.
what kind of a surge it was.
Yeah.
Actually, I didn't have an expert at the time, but I knew that if it was going to be a battle of the experts, after the jury took one good look at those poor, mutilated young girls,
mm-hmm.
we would be finished. I could see a possible multi-million-dollar verdict. So did the Aetna. I took the electrical wire with the melted portion, along with the plug, to the Dade County Building Department, the government, the county building department.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked to have the government engineer examine it. He was told the story, and he was instructed not to alter the exhibit. You can't cut it, change it, bend it. You know, mm-hmm. it's an exhibit in court.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if there was an explanation from the county, the jury would be more impressed than a private engineer who you paid a lot of money to become come in as an expert,
right.
And they become a paid expert, you mm-hmm. know, and people are skeptical. But the building engineer from the county, he doesn't get anything, and he comes with an aura of authenticity to him.
Mm. Okay. And how did that go?
Well, I was amazed at what he did. The county engineer took a razor, and he sliced open the plug against my instructions.
Oh, boy.
And he, lo and behold, he found that the plug was for a 220-watt outlet, not a 110 outlet, which was the normal wiring of the home. The home was wired 110, and this machine required 220.
Right.
So they had the wrong plug. And what he did, the guy that installed it, was he took a plier and twisted the plug. The plug would not fit in. It's built.
Oh,
the 220
my gosh.
Plug will not fit into a 110 outlet.
No.
So he twisted the plug so it would fit in. That's how we
oh
fixed
my
it.
Gosh.
So
no plugged. Wonder.
That's right. You had a 220 watt appliance plugged into a 110 watt outlet by twisting the prong of the plug.
No.
Well, the county building engineer didn't issue a written report. And I had him on standby to testify. And we clearly weren't responsible. It was a case to win.
Mm-hmm.
What about those poor girls? Well, I'm not a socialist, and it's not my job to look after everybody. However, I didn't think it would be out of place to make some kind of a settlement offer to the girls. And we did. We offered them $100,000,
mm-hmm.
which wasn't a lot, but it would cover a little bit of their education and help them along in life.
Yeah. Or at least a down payment to a new place.
Right, right.
I don't know. So what happened next? Did you ever hear?
Well, the plaintiff's side,
mm-hmm.
You know, the girl's side, didn't take the county engineer's deposition. They didn't take his sworn statement.
Mm-hmm.
His name was on the list as a potential witness. I wasn't about to tell him anything. They didn't ask. I didn't tell.
Mm-hmm.
They would find some way, if I told them, to get a phony expert to go around the defense and say that it didn't matter whether the plug was twisted. People will lie and say anything for money.
Yeah.
So I was lucky because they never saw it coming. I made the $100,000 offer, which they rejected out of hand. I can't blame them. It was a multi-million dollar claim.
Yeah. Mm.
And the trial started. And it was my turn to make opening statements. The judge says, Mr. Ress, it's your turn to address the jury.
Mm-hmm.
So my opening statement, I said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, how many of you are familiar with Perry Mason? Have you seen his show on TV? Have you seen him in the movies? They all nodded. In those days, everybody knew of the famous Perry Mason.
Hmm.
Who was Perry Mason? Well, he was like Sherlock Holmes.
Okay.
They had a show, Perry Mason, you know, on TV, and he
solved the crime. Like a detective show?
Yeah, it was on television. It was a detective show, very famous. Well, today I'm going to be Perry Mason, and I'm going to solve this mystery right before
like
your
Columbo,
eyes.
Like Columbo.
Yeah, right, like Columbo. And I'm going to show you how and why this fire started, and it will prove without a shred of a doubt that my client, Happy Holmes, and Bill Humble were absolutely guiltless. They didn't do anything wrong, and they did not in any way cause this terrible fire. And I will tell you how the fire started, and it wasn't our fault. Whoa, you could hear a pin drop.
Yeah, what happened after that?
Well,
how did that go over?
Well, opposing counsel, they were Pete and Gray with their names, they were dumbstruck. They stood there having with their mouth open.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever heard anything like that in a courtroom before. You don't do those things. And the judge was in a state of shock. And no one ever had ever heard anything like that in an opening statement. I'm
mm-hmm.
going to be
what
Perry
got into
Mason,
you?
And I'm going to prove that I'm not guilty.
What got into you?
I don't know. You know, you become a showman. Yeah, I went wild.
Yeah.
So either I was crazy or I was loaded.
Uh-huh.
So opposing counsel asked for a brief recess. And Joe Pete comes up to me and he looks me in the eye. He says, Lewis, are you serious? What in the devil do you have? And it was the Joe Pete and the Phil Gray. These guys were very famous, experienced lawyers, very famous. And they were highly regarded. And they were looking right in my eyes.
Yeah, they're probably dumbstruck.
They knew I was a guy. I couldn't lie. Yeah. There's nothing. You lie, you're disbarred. Mm-hmm. and your case could be ruined. I said, Joe, I'm truly loaded. If you accept the settlement offer, which I'm still holding out, but which I'm compelled to withdraw once we get started with the trial itself, I'll show you what I have, and you will be satisfied. Bear in mind that I have to live with you guys the rest of my professional life. Well, after a brief conference, they talked with one another, and they said, Joe Pete comes back to me. He says, Lewis, there's no such thing as a bluff here. We trust you to explain it to us, and we'll take the settlement.
Okay.
So it was a matter of trust. So we entered into the settlement in open court, and the judge approved it. And then I showed them the sliced open plug and explained to them how the fire happened, that the neighbor who was with the $50 had bent mm-hmm. the plug and stuck it into the wrong socket, and that was what caused the fire.
So, those were some real cases, honestly. Like, the plug thing is just mind-blowing. Whatever happened to Don Fowler?
Oh, yeah. I started to tell you about the arson cases.
Yeah.
Well, so we had started representing travelers because of these arson cases,
mm-hmm.
and we had gotten more and more of their work. In the meantime, Don Fowler took off with all the Aetna files. So there must have been like 50 files that he took with him.
Mm-hmm. Quite a lot.
Yeah, and I should have been suspicious when Don Fowler and his wife failed to show up at a number of office weddings and firm parties, leaving empty seats at the round banquet table. I mean, ought to open your eyes about what he thought of you. I mm-hmm. never thought of it. He always said, I couldn't make it. I didn't feel well.
Excuses, and,
I never thought that he would be this devious. Unfortunately, we had to pay Don Fowler off.
Yeah.
I swallowed hard because he took the Aetna, a client I had nurtured for many years. I had entertained the adjusters. I had taken out the supervisors. I took them on fishing trips. I handled their closings of their homes without charge. I visited the home office of the Aetna in Hartford so many times, and our first major client was the Aetna. And Fowler kept the files which had been in our office and which he had the Aetna transfer to him. So he was to handle the Aetna's future work, and on top of it, I had to pay him a large sum of money.
I would be so upset.
I got tattooed. We had lost the Aetna, but we had picked up travelers.
Good.
So during the 2 years that we had been representing travelers, we had developed good relationships with them. I told you we were handling a lot of work for them, not just the arson cases.
Mm-hmm.
And one day the phone rings, and it's Marty Spencer. He says, Lewis, Marty Spencer talking. That's how he said, Marty Spencer talking. Yes, Marty. Lewis, Travelers has bought out the Aetna's casualty business. The Aetna is just going to handle group medical insurance. And I have had all of the Aetna's files picked up from Don Fowler, and they are in a truck to you. They're on its way to your office right now.
That's amazing.
You've worked on some of these files already, and I will be adding a number of relatively new Aetna files. I hope you and your firm continue to represent us as well as you've been doing.
Wow, that is unbelievable. Talk about karma, just, you know. Coming around the corner there,
yeah, Marty,
full circle.
I said, Marty, thanks. Thanks a million.
Well.
Yeah, that's, like that?
Yeah, great
You can't
story.
Make stories like that.
No,
up, you know?
No.
So,
wow.
And there's a lot to learn.
Oh, there is.
There's a lot
so
to learn
much.
From it.
You got three stories here. The first is about having your files taken and then getting them back. The second about arson, where a fire was intentionally set. And then the third about having a neighbor do a cheap electrical installation, you know, creating a fire. You're trusting someone and then they pretty much botch the job and end up scarring your children and almost killing you. So, let's see, like, kind of your insights in here. What about you being creative as an attorney? You know, the whole Perry Mason thing, being dramatic. You got to tell me a lot here.
Well, thank you for being that interested, because it's quite a challenge you're outlining. First of all, when you're doing a trial, it's a theater. It's a form of theater.
Mm.
But you got to be very careful to be honest and not to exaggerate,
mm-hmm.
because the jury will hold your feet to the fire. Yeah. And they remember what you say. And if I had gotten up and said, oh, I'm going to be Perry Mason and solve the crime, and I didn't do it, mm-hmm. I would have been a dead duck. I would have been yes. finished. So that's the first thing. There are a lot of and law is specialized, and experts are all specialized. And getting a good expert is who's believable.
Yep, that's another thing.
Is mm-hmm. very important, who is above the politics of the specialty in which he's in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's they're very important. Sometimes, if you really want to be a little devious, you can go out and hire every really top expert in the area and have a $500 or $1,000 consultation with them and pay them $1,000 and go to their office and talk to them about the case. Now they can't come into the case against you.
Oh.
So you bought them out of the case. That's a dirty trick.
Yeah.
But especially if you know the other firm uses that expert all the time.
Exactly.
And the expert is so hungry for the money, they're very money-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
You can go in there and give
them
$1,000 and say, I got
to
talk to you about a case. And most of them will say, it doesn't involve Pete and Gray, does it? If it does, they won't talk to you. If it does, then they'll... If they don't ask you the question, you cannot
then
come out. Pete and Gray can't call them.
They can't, yeah.
So that's one of the things. Another thing is sometimes you ask them, you give them a list of names, experts, and you say, is there any one of these people, who would you defer to? If you were, take their side's deposition of their expert, and you
uh-huh.
say, who do you think knows more about this than you do?
Oh.
You're not the world's leading expert. Who is the world's leading expert? Well, one day, a guy said to me, well, the world's leading expert who I would defer to is so-and-so at the Brooklyn Jewish Hospital in New York.
Huh.
Well, I got him to be my expert, and that was they were finished.
Yeah.
That was the end of that case.
Right, you got the best of the best.
I went up there
yep.
after I got his name from this fellow who said he would defer to him, and I said, do you think such and such could happen? And he said, no, not medically. I said, good, you're my expert. He
mm-hmm.
says, I don't want to be. He says, I don't want to be an expert. Well, a few calls to the hospital administrator mm-hmm. and some mm-hmm. other people that my family knew up there, and he said, okay, I'm told to be nice to you.
Okay,
so
Lewis.
So he became my expert. So it's a lot of politics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we talk about arson.
Mm-hmm.
Arson. Well, arson is a funny thing. You were right. It's deliberately setting a fire
mm-hmm.
and to property. Okay. Usually, it's a building or a vehicle or a boat. There are. It's a lot of them. There are 1.4 million fires in 2020 was the last statistic I could find.
Wow.
That's
a lot.
Yeah, it caused 3,500 deaths. And there were 15,200 people injured in 2020 from fires. Property damage was $21.9 billion in the United States.
Yeah.
So it's a big thing. A lot of it is not caused for money. A lot of it is caused by arsonists who are crazy.
Mm.
These people like to stay pyromaniacs, pyromaniac. So 60% of the young white males mostly make up the people that do it.
How surprising.
This is not a racial thing. This is not a religious thing. This is not Hispanics or anything like that. These are young white males. 60% are under the age of 18. 80% of them are under the age of 29.
Hmm. They just want to burn it all down.
Yeah. 70% of them have prior felony arrests.
Hmm.
70%, so these are criminals.
Yeah.
They do it because,
they
and they're crazy. They're uneducated. They're not beyond the 10th grade, most of them. And one-third of them remain at the scene after they set the fire.
So just to
watch.
Thought
you'd be interested
just want to watch
in that. Yeah. They're often serial arsonists. Frequently to collect insurance, but not mostly. The prison terms, if there's people in the building, you can get up to 30 years in prison.
Yeah, it's serious.
If there are no people in the building, then it's a second-degree felony, and it's like 10 years.
Hmm.
So I think that gives you a good insight.
Yeah,
you have to, arson, the fire has to be intentionally caused. And usually in an insurance case, it's got to be by the policyholder. You may have an enemy. You may have a competitor
exactly.
who hires a guy to torch your
yep.
factory.
Yeah, it wasn't you.
Put you out of business.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's arson is not just the sole issue. It's got to be set by the person who tends to benefit from the insurance. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So usually you want to look at the books and see if they're in economic trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a fire, an arson, is an arson. It doesn't matter who commits it. Some policies cover arson no matter who commits it,
mm-hmm.
but most don't. Then there's a question of inflated claims. You can have some property damage, and you say, well, the odor, the smoke ruined everything in the home.
Yeah.
So I need the whole house replaced when it's in one room or one part of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of issues on the extent of the injured damage becomes a big issue
damage
in an arson
costs,
case.
All that. Yeah.
Then there's a question of what's going on in the house or the property. Was an illegal activity going on? Well, a lot of them, they're making drugs, they're manufacturing bombs, you know.
Yikes.
You don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Then a lot of them are the result of people doing home improvements themselves.
Mm.
So somebody says, well, I'm not going to permit and I'm not going to get a contractor. I can build this addition to my Florida room myself. I'll just get some lumber. I'll go down there. I'll pour some concrete, and I'll put these things in, and I'll get the wire, and I'll wire it up.
Yikes.
Well, so
yeah, not a
electrical
good idea.
Work without permits, that's very big, and no inspections.
Mm.
And you can build up when they catch you, you can get huge fines for that.
Yeah.
Or if the home is vacant, you may not be covered. Or you may have a lot of newspapers in there and have spontaneous combustion from the newspapers piled up.
Mm.
So those are some of the arson things. There's a school. There's a number of schools. The National Fire Academy. You know, this is a big business. And the fire department sent people there. And the fire department's got to go out and risk their lives to put it out. The insurance companies have an interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the alarm system people have an interest in it. And the people who sell fire equipment and extinguishers have an interest. It's a big business.
Yeah, it is.
People don't realize it. So they train and they go to the schools. They have a number of them. There's the Florida National Fire Academy, the National Institute of Justice, the Miami-Dade College Academy of Fire Sciences, the Intercontinental Fire Training Academy.
Wow.
They're all over.
Yeah.
And some of them are pretty good. And, of course, they teach you to look for the signs of arson.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the signs of arson? Well, a large amount of damage. And there's no, the burning pattern is unique generally from a point where it starts. You can see where it
they
was.
They kind of spread all over.
Yeah, well, it was torched. So
you
can see where it starts. There are a lack of accidental causes or explanations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be able to explain how it happened. Sometimes something drops or boils over or leaks. And or inflammables get out, so there has to be a reason.
Some
if
kind
there's
of a
no
trail
reason,
or something.
It looks more like arson.
Mm-hmm.
The absence of valuable items, if it's in the
how
home.
How convenient that all my valuables are no longer
you
inside.
You got it. That's
yes.
another one, right?
That's funny.
The same person shows up at the fires at unconnected fires. It's this guy.
Oh, hey,
picture.
Look. it's Joe again.
Right. There's multiple points of origin sometimes. That's highly unusual. So you pour here and you pour there and you pour gas in three places and light it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that kind of stuff. The fire doesn't act normally. It doesn't burn normally. The color of the smoke.
Hmm.
The sprinkler systems are damaged.
That's interesting, the color of the smoke, too, because it's
probably
the chemical used,
right.
et cetera.
And the suspicious behavior of the property owner.
Hmm.
So those are things, motives, you know. A lot of people are motives, are pyromaniacs. They're vandals. They're thrill seekers. Maybe they burn it to conceal a crime. That's very common. They murder somebody, and then they set the house on fire. They pour gasoline over them and light a fire.
Get rid of the evidence. Revenge
is a big thing. Now there's a lot of bombings and stuff. There's hate bombings. So there's politics and hate crimes and a lot of mental illness. So I think I've given you an idea about arson. And of course, if you have to have a defense, so if you have an alibi, where is the owner at the time? Well, if the owner's in Chicago when the fire breaks out in Miami, it's a little tough to hang it on him.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, he could have hired someone.
And sometimes they say, well, you went in without permission. It's an unlawful search and seizure. So those are the things. Or I had authority, or I was told to start this fire.
What?
That I was instructed to do it by the owner.
Oh, okay.
They catch the guy that did it, and he says, don't blame me. I'm under instruction. He was threatening
me. I was hired.
He
told me he wanted to, you know, set this on fire. So I did it.
I'll tell you what else I learned about this thing. When you hire somebody in a law firm or in a business, there are two schools of thought. One is when you're going to work for somebody and they say, sign here, you can't compete. If you leave us, you're blocked from competing within so many miles of where you're working now. You can't solicit any of our customers. And we're not going to pay you a buyout on your partnership ownership if you compete. That's a good way of doing it. If I had said to Fowler, look, if you go out and compete with us, I'm going to give you only 10 cents on the dollar for the buyout on your ownership in the firm because you're competing with us. So you have to go to an area where you're not competing, out of the county. I didn't do that. I should have. I should have said you will not solicit any of our clients or former clients. You will not take any of your files with you. I could have said stuff like that.
Right.
And I didn't think it was professional. I don't know how much you can do today. I know in doctors' offices,
there's definitely not competes all the time.
You can't solicit the patients. Some of them even don't let you operate in the hospitals where they operate. So it's a very interesting area.
And it's across
industries.
You get
into non-competitive.
It's across industries because photography, videography, even dress designers, like fashion designers that work for big boutiques, they have non-competes where they can't go and design their own dresses. Things like that. It's all over.
And then, of course, it's a free country, so you can't stop people from making a living.
They'd have to switch careers, really.
it's very interesting problem as to how much you can limit people.
Yeah, there's usually terms like, you know, within the next 5 years or something like that.
It has to be reasonable distance, reasonable time, and reasonable restriction.
Okay, great. Thanks, Louis. Learned quite a bit.
It's a pleasure.
All right, until next time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs, and be sure to pick up a copy of Louis Rest's new book on Amazon.